Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, CMPD reports homicides are up 31% in 2024 and adds,
any homicide in Charlotte is one too many.
A major development announcement. City Council okays a project in Ballantyne that includes a new middle school, and South Park unveils a new vision plan for itself. The UNC Board of Governors passes a policy that threatens diversity, equity, and inclusion policies at the state's public universities. Gaston County is one step closer to being home to a lithium mine. And Wegmans is coming. Wegmans is coming. Did I tell you that? Wegmans is coming? It's coming. Joe Bruno is here. He's a reporter for WSOC-TV. He broke the story, and he hosts the Political Beat on Sunday mornings. He's here along with WFAE senior editor Eli Portillo. Alexandria Sands reports for Axios Charlotte, and Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning. Welcome to you all.
Good morning.
Well, as we mentioned a moment ago, CMPD held the first quarter public safety briefing on Monday, announcing a 31% increase in homicides this year. But according to CMPD Deputy Chief Zero Chicory, the department has arrested a suspect in a large percentage of those cases.
Homicide unit has already cleared 70% of our cases this year. Our five-year average, which we report out typically at the end of the year, in 2023, was as high as 80%. The national average is just over 50%.
So, to what did they attribute their success in apprehending suspects in these homicides? I'm not sure who to ask that of.
Well, wow. You know, I think when you look at these statistics, I don't want to call it randomness, but there is some, you know, just normal variation where, you know, for example, there was a triple homicide, a really tragic situation with a mother and two kids who were killed recently in Charlotte. And, you know, that both adds a big jump in the first quarter homicide total, three killings, and also one suspect was arrested there. So you're clearing three of those with one arrest. So there is some just kind of, you know, fluctuation that happens here. What I think is really interesting about the homicides going up in Charlotte significantly, though, is that we're bucking a national trend here. Homicides have been going down in major U.S. cities since 2022. And in fact, just, you know, I think on Thursday, yesterday, or maybe it was earlier in the week, the Wall Street Journal had a story that in the 133 largest U.S. cities, homicides are down an average of 20%. So we are going the other way, and that's a concerning trend.
Do we understand why? Because we're talking about cities like New York and Philadelphia and Boston, where these crimes drop 20%. We're up 31%. Do we understand why?
I don't think there was... Go ahead, Eli.
Oh, no. Please go ahead.
I was just going to say, I don't think that we have a clear reason why, other than what we've talked about a lot in the past year or two, which is we have the proliferation of guns and we have a lot of violence among younger residents in Charlotte. That seems to be a trend that has continued. And also to Eli's point, I think, you know, the CMPD said one homicide is too many. Absolutely. But when we get into numbers, it's 34 versus 26. So the percentage is going to look large quickly. But still, it's a horrible trend. And it's something we've talked about on this show so many times. I think we had, 95 homicides last year. That was down from 107. But we're always flirting with a record or near record rate of homicides here in the past 5-6 years.
So, Deputy Chief,
and if you look back,
go ahead.
I just wanted to say, context-wise, if you look back 10 years or so, we were averaging, you know, maybe in the 50s or 60s. So the trend over the past few years, both versus national trends and also versus Charlotte history, is consistently moving in the wrong way, even as it fluctuates some year to year.
So Deputy Chief Chicory called these 34 deaths in 3 months an alarming number, his words, and a pace that we should not tolerate as a city. That announcement came after three people were killed last Friday. So what measures, Joe, are police taking to quell these rising numbers? What's going on? What are they doing?
Well, they have a lot more focus on the ground policing, community policing. They've had some success with targeted measures in specific corridors of opportunity where they, you know, are in the group working with the community. And, you know, we also just heard from an apartment complex, the Little Rock apartment complex in West Charlotte, that their partnership with CMPD on security has contributed to a decrease in crime at their complex. So, you know, there are pockets of success that can be attributed, I think, to a more enhanced community policing program. But also CMPD is looking to, you know, enhance efforts in Uptown. They have specific task force that are looking at crime, like from the Transit Center to Romier Bearden. So those are some of the more targeted areas as they look to quell this violence. You know, it's really tough, even though most of these homicides, the victim and the suspect know each other. That doesn't really give a whole lot of comfort to the community when you have one of those homicides being a group home worker who was beat to death by a 16-year-old. Of course, we had the other homicide that happened over Easter weekend where a young man was shot and killed inside a fast food restaurant. Again, suspects know the victim in this case, but when you have these high profile incidents in the public, it doesn't really do much to help people's fears.
Eric.
Well, I was just going to say, and to add to that, again, going back to the proliferation of guns and people shooting all over town, we had the five people shot Romier Bearden Park on New Year's Eve. I don't think there were any deaths. And Joe, I think you reported maybe Tuesday night there were all those shots fired in First Ward, no deaths. But again, you know, We all know when gunshots are being fired, good things never happen.
I suppose it goes without saying, but I guess it also bears repeating that behind these numbers are human beings, the lives of human beings and families of human beings who are impacted by this. And Joe, your colleague at Channel 9, Hunter Sines, seems to draw the short straw all the time and has to go out and talk to some of these folks in the aftermath of this. And this week he spoke with Jacqueline Lewis, a Charlotte native who lost her son and grandson years ago to gun violence. She now works with the families of other victims and says it feels like she is constantly being called to shooting scenes.
It gives me pain because now I'm right back out here doing the same thing I just did yesterday. We got to have a solution. If not, we're going to be burying children all summer long.
Not only are they children, Deputy Chief Chicory says the suspects and the victims are getting younger and younger and younger. Do we know what the average age is or how these young people are getting guns or what sets them off?
No, we don't. But over, I've just, you know, having covered probably dozens of homicides over the past couple of years, the one thing that I've heard from police constantly with young people being the suspect is that for whatever reason, it's that people don't throw hands, they don't get in fist fights anymore. It immediately escalates to violence and guns. And it's a really difficult problem to tackle.
So at Monday's press conference, CMPD Lieutenant Kevin, I think you say it, Petrus, P-I-E-T-R-U-S, was quoted in the Charlotte Observer as saying, quote, "We feel that keeping the lines of communications open, keeping those in our community and our partners here in the media abreast as to what the conditions are in our city is important. So that's why we're here quarterly." But haven't those press conferences just become quarterly? Didn't last year, weren't they all the time and they've made them quarterly? And would more frequent information sessions change this equation in any way?
More frequent information is always welcomed and encouraged. For example, the First Ward Park shooting that happened earlier this week, it happened at 9 o'clock. We didn't get any information until the next morning at 9 a.m. So that's just an example when you have community members all swarming the scene and asking us what's going on. And we don't have much to tell them other than there appears to be a shooting and a car ditched in the middle of a park. That's a problem. I think that quarterly press conferences on crime stats have been something CMPD did regularly in the past, and I would encourage them to continue to be forthcoming with information.
If I recall correctly, Joe, these used to be once a week, and you used to have access to public information officers who could tell you things, and now they want to produce or have been producing videos explaining the story in their words with their video. How's that worked out?
We could do a whole hour on this, Mike. There are times where our jobs are difficult, like with the First Ward Park shooting, for example, that I was at earlier this week. And there are times where CMPD has been helpful for us. They have added bi-weekly Ask Us Anything sessions, which are helpful. Again, it's a work in progress. We both are trying to figure out something that works for the community because that's the most important thing.
Meanwhile, CMPD announced this week that violent crime is down 1% year to year. Murder to me seems violent. So how do they define violent crimes?
I believe they're referring to violent crimes other than murder. If okay. That, yeah. If
yeah. That, makes sense. That also includes, you know, your aggravated assaults and armed robberies. Well, so you've got a lot more than just the universe of murders there.
But I ask this not just because of the murder rate being up, but because police statistics show that 17 shootings into occupied homes have happened so far this year, involving 74 victims, a 42% increase from the first quarter of last year. Again, not a violent crime. How can violent crime be down?
Well, it's 1%. So if you look at the raw numbers of those, you know, aggravated assaults and armed robberies, you know, you're really talking a couple dozen less out of more than, I believe, 1,000. So it's a small change, and the murders have gone up, obviously.
Since the beginning of the year, juvenile suspects are responsible for 21 shootings and more than 220 of the 280 auto theft arrests. So on Tuesday night, Mecklenburg County Commissioners approved the Juvenile Crime Prevention Council's $2 million funding allocation request. Nicole Beverly is interim chair of that organization, and she told WSOC-TV she is confident that progress can be made.
Our goal is to really make sure that the youth are succeeding in Mecklenburg County.
So how do they work toward that goal, Joe? Where will this money go?
There are about a dozen different programs, nonprofits, and agencies that will get this funding. The most funding that goes to one specific agency is about $260,000, but it includes money to like the CMPD diversion program, for the struggle, that's a nonprofit, different mentor programs. So the money will really be focused on mentorship, vocational programs, and substance abuse counseling.
As you said, there are a number of programs aimed at doing this, to quelling this youth violence. And Mecklenburg County Commissioner Mark Jarrell wants to see some hard numbers to determine whether, particularly in this case, this money makes any difference.
I really don't have any idea of what the impact of any of these organizations are doing, how we measure that, and how that translates into the communities.
And in response, Nicole Beverly shared some of what the Juvenile Crime Prevention Council's plans happen to be.
We actually are face to face with the youth that we serve, that the youth that the programs or organizations serve, with parents and having conversations with them. Youth having surveys and getting their impact and what they feel like they receive from the program and how it's changed their lives.
So I have 30 seconds, Joe. Was he satisfied with that answer, or will they have to report back with harder numbers?
I think they'll probably have to report back, but he was satisfied with the answer. From what I understand, this group really does keep track of this stuff. It's just a matter of presenting it to officials.
Okay, when we come back from the break, City Council was busy this week with approving some things and big development coming to Ballantyne, which we'll talk about, some Charlotte rezoning in South Charlotte. And South Park has broken out a whole new plan for themselves, which we will also talk about when the WFAE News Roundup continues. Stay with us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE. Eli Portillo, our senior editor, is with us from WFAE News. Alexandria Sands reports for Axios Charlotte. Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Joe Bruno is here. He's an anchor of their political beat program on Sundays and a reporter for WSOC-TV News. Joe, it's the Joe Show at the moment, so let me go back to Joe. Since the beginning of the year, juvenile suspects, I've already done that, excuse me. Let's go back to this. Let's do this. Jeez, I should be organized, shouldn't I? Charlotte City Council voted this week to allow a huge new development in Ballantyne. So where and what do they have planned for this?
So, Eric. I don't know who you were asking, so I'm just going to jump in and somebody stop me. Stop me. So this is the Cato Farm site on Tom Short Road. This has been a very noisy project. 3,500 residents had petitioned against it, concerned about traffic, but council gave it the okay by a vote of 10-1. Dimple Ashmira was the lone no vote, and it's 900 new residents, and a CMS middle school is the project. So,
yeah, it's apartments, it's townhomes, it's single family homes, it's a middle school for CMS. As you mentioned, some residents were not pleased with this. About 3,500 of them signed a petition opposing it. But Ed Driggs, the Republican city councilman who represents that area, kind of said that killing this proposal really wouldn't accomplish anything.
What would happen if this got denied tonight is that some other plan would be submitted and we would be here all over again. It would probably be a lot like this one. So I don't think there's anything to be gained from turning this down.
What he's saying is that growth and development go hand in hand and are inevitable. So is the traffic that comes with it. And this is a constant source of conversation in Charlotte as we continue to grow and not do much about the streets or transportation. How long is this sustainable, this kind of stuff?
Well, we've had... Go ahead, Eli. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I don't know that there is a limit on it. Look at Los Angeles. Has anyone stopped building there because the traffic on the freeways is really bad? So, you know, I don't know. I think it'll just keep growing outward. I will say, you know, if you look at this particular development in Ballantyne, back up just 25 years and all of Ballantyne was farmland like this. So... I sympathize with residents who are worried about traffic. I live in South Charlotte and I sat for 25 minutes on Carmel Road earlier this week, just trying to make a turn. And it was very frustrating, but at the same time, in some ways it feels like the barn door's already open and the cows are all out to pasture or something.
because
he went very agriculture with that.
Because Ballantyne is a relatively new area in terms of development, it's been there since the beginning of time. We just haven't called it Ballantyne nor put houses there. There's some room to grow, but there's probably less room to grow along Providence Road. And City Council is considering three rezoning petitions to build hundreds of new housing units, including 100 affordable housing units, on Providence Road between Lindbridge Lane and Old Providence Road. And some on the council appear to like this plan, but they're also grappling with more traffic on Providence Road. So, Joe, what do they like about this proposal?
Well, for one thing, hundreds of affordable housing units will be built without a taxpayer paying anything for them. So that's a positive of the project. It will really activate an area that doesn't have a whole lot of development. Providence Square is there right now. It's kind of in rough shape. Hasn't been upgraded in quite some time. So this would bring some new retail and grocery options to that part and also build hundreds of housing units. Again, though, Providence Road is a nightmare almost at any time of day, so they have to weigh the risk of increased traffic against all the pros of this development.
Well, if they approve this, I'm not sure how many, it's 100 affordable. How many units are going in if this is approved?
Well, it's hundreds, maybe more than 1,000, because there's three developments, and then about more than 100, close to 200 of them would be affordable housing.
So what will this do to traffic? Have traffic engineers gotten involved in this discussion to tell people what this is going to do?
Those studies are underway, and this is not a project where council will be expected to vote on it next month. They kind of pushed this forward because they needed to have a hearing on it. But the one thing I will say is, you know, we saw so much backlash to the CMS project that we just talked about. This one doesn't have a whole lot of community opposition. And I think it's because the three developers of the projects are really engaging with the community. There is still some, and those concerns about Providence Road exist, but the concerns really, it's not really escalating into a really contentious rezoning just yet.
Eli, can I hazard a guess here? An expert guess? Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say Eli.
Yes, I'll just say, I'll just say really quickly, you know, I think there's also the possibility that if you build more retail, more stores, more things like that in this part of Providence, which is part of it, then maybe people won't have to drive up and down Providence so far to get to grocery stores. So that's what developers will tell you, like, hey, this actually could cut down some of that traffic by giving people an alternative to driving farther. Okay. But I know Eric, like, cannot stop himself from talking about development this morning.
I'm fine. I was actually just going with the sarcastic, can I hazard a guess it will get worse? But also, more seriously, Charlotte, like many cities, doesn't say no to development very often. It's hard to resist the allure of more investment. And I think we see that as we go around the city. And these are just further examples of that.
And changes are likely to come to the South Park area. Alex, you say South Park wants to become a place where you rarely have to move your car. Now that would be a transformation. What do they have in mind?
Yeah, so South Park Community Partners released their vision plan this week. It's only a two-year-old organization, so this is kind of a big deal for them. And it outlines a bunch of projects. A lot of those have to do with mobility and connection, walking paths. Which the idea is that by 2035, you can use one of the thousands of parking spots in South Park and never have to move your car. And you could take the South Park Loop. You could take different walking connections. I believe in the plan, it's a path underneath South Park Mall. So,
okay. They call this the South Park Forward 2035 Vision Plan. It's a roadmap for development. It's being pitched by city officials and organizers of this relatively new organization, the South Park Community Partners. Adam Rue is president and CEO of that group, and he told QC News that they want to
stitch together the great patches that we already have into a more amazing quilt.
This plan consists, as I understand it, Alex, of 64 projects over the next decade, organized into three categories: places, connections, and mobility. And City Council's Tariq Bukhari, who represents that area, says a successful future for the area relies on bold and actionable planning.
The future success of South Park is not guaranteed to us.
Eric, when you wrote about this in the Business Journal, you described this as putting the park back into South Park. There was a park there?
Yeah, but that's what I was wondering. Those were actually the words of Land Design's CEO, who was one of the consultants on this study. You know, the thing, of course, being the Business Journal, the thing that jumped out at us is $250 million price tag, a mixture of public and private funding, but there's no delineation, at least yet, of how much will be public and how much will be private. We certainly know that there is enough corporate horsepower to provide a lot of funding, but these will turn into interesting discussions inevitably, as they do, even with the project that Alex mentioned, which is one of the signature projects, the Loop, which is this, you know, sort of urban trail. It's 3 miles. They've built 8% of it. It's a $35 million project. They don't know where the rest of the money's coming from. Doesn't mean it won't happen, but I think this is very aspirational. Let's say it that way.
Yeah, this is not just the mall. This is a one square mile area encompassing the mall, Phillips Place, Morrowcroft Village, and Piedmont Town Center. And they want to redesign Symphony Park, complete construction of the loop, as you said, and then launch this shuttle service for the district. So you can just hop aboard a shuttle and go from one place to another. Some of these things we've talked about years ago, the loop for one being one, the shuttle being another. aside from the loop being semi under construction, have they done anything else yet?
I think they've done a lot of talk. Go ahead, Alex. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, I feel like that's kind of the point of the plan, is that they have a lot of these projects that have been, people have thought about them for a while. So it's ambitious, but attainable. And I think it's going to create a lot of excitement. It's just to try to get those private dollars to fund the projects. It's just a matter of, like, is that going to die down?
And the illustration, the design that I saw for Symphony Park appears to have removed the Symphony Band shell from that area. Would that be correct?
I don't.
Go ahead, Alex.
No, I didn't notice that or ask about it.
Okay.
They would have to rename it, I suppose.
I guess they would. Nearly half of City Council and Mayor Vi Lyles showed up for this announcement on Tuesday, and the mayor is on board.
This is something that's going to be absolutely astounding change for the better for so much of what we do.
And developers like Peter Pappas, CEO of Pappas Properties, believe continued support from officials is critical.
Without a working relationship with them as we go forward, we can't really maximize the value of South Park. And it would be a shame not to do that.
So you've mentioned that this is going to require funding, but does it require any approvals from the city or the city council to get this done, or is it a done deal?
Eric. Oh, no. These projects will come likely one by one. All of them will not be publicly funded or include public funding. But yes, when the city spends on these projects, they will have to approve that. Just one other quick observation, Mike, I was going to make is listening to the comments of the mayor and Peter Pappas is how similar this is to what we've seen in Ballantyne, these suburban neighborhoods in Charlotte and other cities really trying to modernize, become more attractive to younger residents and younger professionals and be more walkable and more navigable.
So we've been talking for years about something else, and that is the proposed Red Line commuter train from the Lake Norman area to Uptown. Now I'm told they want to take it from Mooresville to Uptown. Norfolk Southern's tracks are necessary to make that happen. Norfolk Southern has kept on saying no until recently, when that no has turned into something resembling a possibility. And this week, Katz began holding public meetings to get feedback on the proposed Red Line because, as Brian Nadolny, senior project manager for the Red Line, explained to WCNC-TV, the original plans, this is how long we've been talking about this, the original plans came out in 2008. And guess what? They now need some updating.
Since 2008, there's been so much growth in this part of the county that a lot of the original designs, like where the stations were planned on going, has changed.
So last fall, Charlotte agreed to pay a contractor $5 million to update the design to account for growth and change. How does the plan shape up now, Alex?
Well, we're looking at 10 stations. I think one of the biggest takeaways is we have to consider, are we going to shift those stations a little bit based on all the development in the area? Are they still going to make sense? And then also, do we need to add new stations like one in Camp North End? There's a pretty, if you look at the map, it seems like there's a pretty big gap in the train in that North End area, which is growing a lot. And that's a place where people want to have a lot of density. So there's potential to add a stop there. And then they're also considering things that have just changes in travel behavior that have really just started since the pandemic. Like, people aren't really just traveling at the typical 9 a.m., 5 p.m. hours anymore. They kind of want to target more of the everyday essential worker and people who are trying to get to their medical appointment, things like that. And then also, I think we've talked about this on the show recently, but the huge boom in tourism that Charlotte is seeing. A lot of people are using the light rail more for like sporting events and things like that. So these are all factors that they're trying to take into consideration as they update the designs.
Eli.
So one of the biggest changes is, like Alex was saying, we're not necessarily going to need a commuter line to take people at 9 a.m. downtown and then at 5 p.m. back up north. So originally there were 16 to 28 trips per day planned on the Red Line. clustered around those morning and afternoon rush hours. Now they're looking at 42 trips a day, kind of spread more evenly to accommodate that. So doubling or more the number of daily trips, you know, is going to require more trains, more operators. So one of the most important things they're doing is updating a cost estimate, because it's been a long time since CATS has priced this out. And since then, you know, looking at major service changes, post-COVID inflation, the price tag is likely to go up significantly.
Let me ask a question that only deserves a quick answer, and that is, a lot of naysayers, people who don't want these trains to go through because they say they're immobile. Once they're there, and you can't move them like a bus. This plan came out in 2008. That's 16 years ago, and we're making changes to the plan because of growth and development. If they were to open this thing up today, what would happen 16 years from now?
You mean if they were to start construction today?
No, if they were to actually open and run it today, as this new plan has put it together, yeah. What would happen 16 years from now? Are they making the argument for the people who say the train is a mistake?
You know, they're doing that to some degree. They also have to contend now with something that wasn't there 16 years ago, which is the I-77 express lanes. Back then, you know, love them or hate them, there were no toll lanes to skip some of that traffic. Now buses can use those toll lanes. Drivers can use those. So the argument for the Red Line has always rested in part on there's no alternative to congested 77. Now they have to make a pitch based around the fact that, like I said, you can think they're the worst idea ever, but they do exist. There is an alternative to the congestion to some degree.
So we've been talking about this forever, but there was a two-way meeting to talk to stakeholders and to listen to them about what they thought about this plan this week. And here's what those folks told WCNC-TV.
So much traffic now with the influx of people moving to the area. I'm just excited about the possibility.
Having more options could be a big help.
It's pretty close to some neighborhoods.
We're looking at all these stations with a fresh set of eyes.
Of course, all this hinges on finding the money, some of which would come from the sales tax for transit, which would have to have voter approval, but it would first have to have legislative approval to hold the referendum. We know they don't care for our transit plan because it relies too much on trains and not enough on roads. So are all these meetings, because there was one last night, there's one scheduled for tomorrow in Charlotte, are all these meetings irrelevant?
You know, I think that the Red Line is one key to unlocking the rest of the plan, because if you get the Red Line happening and you get the northern towns on board, that makes it easier to approach the legislature, and the dominoes maybe start falling.
Speaking of the legislature, they have little fingers in the UNC pie. We'll come back and talk about the changes from the UNC Board of Governors, latest news on Mark Robinson, and a lithium mine perhaps being approved for Gaston County. All that and more in a moment. Stay with us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Eli Portillo, our senior editor at WFAE News, is with us for the weekly news roundup. Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. Joe Bruno, a reporter for WSOC-TV and host of their political beat on Sunday mornings. And Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, all here to tell us about the UNC Board of Governors Committee passing a policy this week that could lead to the elimination of diversity, equity, and inclusion officers on all 17 UNC system campuses. It's an unusual move in that the policy passed unanimously without discussion in committee, but still needs to be voted on by the full Board of Governors in May. What message does it send that this passed unanimously without discussion, Eric?
I think the message is that the repeal and replacement of this policy is a near certainty when it goes before the full board next month. I think May 23rd is the vote. The whole argument here is that following the state legislature's lead and legislation that they've passed, that everything be considered on a neutral basis, as it's stated in the law, and so that you can't have these officers measuring DEI, tracking goals for DEI. And if this passes by September 1st, those schools that you just mentioned would have to either reassign or, you know, cut the people that are in those jobs and shift the money to other academic facets of the universities.
And the reason I mentioned the legislature in connection with this is that Andrew Tripp, the senior vice president and general counsel for the UNC system, is the former chief of staff to Republican state Senate leader Phil Berger. He says that this new policy would reaffirm the university's commitment to non-discrimination and institutional neutrality. But others say that this, should this be adopted, it most assuredly would eliminate what are now robust DEI offices, along with the website hub that tracks various DEI programs in place. What will happen? Do we know what will happen as a result? Who's right? Eli.
Well, you know, I think that as the policy is written, it directs universities to, like Eric said, redirect their funding for DEI programs to other, what they're calling student success efforts. It appears that, you know, these programs would go away and, you know, the DEI officers, the people who are charged with diversity on the UNC system campuses would have to be reassigned and their programs would be gone. This is in line with what other states have done, like Texas and Florida. This is not just happening in North Carolina. It is part of a national trend
that in Republican-controlled states. In yeah, Republican that we're seeing states.
These, yeah, we're seeing these programs be straight up removed from colleges.
Eric.
And Mike, you're right to relate this to the legislature and Republican leadership, because remember, the Board of Governors, they are appointed by members of the House and Senate. And since 2010, 2011, Republicans have had the majority in both of those chambers. So this is very much in line with their beliefs and their policies.
A little closer to home, lithium, the elixir of life for the batteries that power your cell phone, your laptop, and electric vehicles, may soon have another source. Piedmont Lithium says the state approved a mining permit, bringing the company one step closer to starting mining operations in Gaston County, although there has been some pushback from people in Charleville. Eric, why?
Residents are concerned about the environmental impact. They're also angry and have been angry for a couple of years about what they consider the company's lack of transparency about what exactly they're going to do and how they're going to do it. And they're also upset, and some of the political leaders over there have been upset, that the CEO, Keith Phillips, of Piedmont Lithium has not been present at some of the town meetings where they're talking about this. As you said, Mike, the state has approved this after a 2.5-year process, but Piedmont Lithium still has to go through some local zoning and approvals. And at the earliest, this will open in 2027.
This would be a $2.1 billion mine and processing plant, which expects to hire over 400 employees with an average salary of $82,000. That seems like a big economic boost to that part of Gaston County. Eli, would it be? Or is that just a little blip?
Yeah. You know, I think it's one of those situations where, yes, it would be a big economic boost, but the people who live nearby are saying, you know, balance that against our interests and worries about pollution and noise and things like that. I think it's interesting that this goes back, or will go back, to a zoning question. Everything relates to local zoning when you get down to it. And remember, the earliest this could open is 2027, like Eric was saying. At the same time, Albemarle, a Charlotte-based company, is also trying to open a major lithium mine, and they have pushed back their timeline and delayed that because of lithium prices falling. So, you know, I think The lithium boom in Gaston County has kind of been just over the horizon for a few years, but it kind of keeps receding. And, you know, I think it's still not guaranteed that we'll see it actually come to pass.
Is the fall in the price of lithium connected in any way to the decreased demand for electric vehicles that seems to be presenting itself right now?
Yes, yes. Okay. There have been, as Eli said, Albemarle has delayed some projects. Piedmont Lithium had some layoffs earlier this year. And so I think Eli's point is spot on. It looks like this potential gold mine, although I guess I'm mixing metaphors and minerals, but there is the concern about, will the electric vehicle market do what everybody thought it was going to do before it began to lag in recent months?
Meanwhile, there's news out of our sister station in Raleigh-Durham, WUNC, and Chapel Hill as well, Eric, Eli, about Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson's wife. She runs a nonprofit. She's run a nonprofit for several years now. And she told the clients of that nonprofit she was shutting down because of her husband's campaign to be the North Carolina governor. But evidently, she told the state a different story.
Yeah, so this gets back to Governor Mark Robinson's wife's nonprofit called Balanced Nutrition. It's based in Greensboro, and this is a nonprofit organization that Mark Robinson has worked for and several other family members have also worked for. And what they do is they connect daycare providers with federal nutrition assistants and help them get nutrition assistance money for food for, low-income kids in their programs. The program is shutting down, like you said, and WUNC's Colin Campbell uncovered that there is some questions from the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services about their finances, about why they haven't had a balanced budget, why their overhead spending appears to be in excess of the 15% limit imposed by the program, and why Yolanda Hill's, Mark Robinson's wife's salary jumped from $71,000 a year 5 years ago to $140,000 per year last year. So it's kind of a different story than what Yolanda Hill told program clients, which is that, you know, it's just too busy with her governor's campaign to run this. I think it's also interesting to note that while Mark Robinson has mostly attracted really fierce criticism from the left, there have been some commentators on the right who have pointed to this kind of family-run nonprofit and said, hey, you know, you're basically running a welfare-funded program here. We don't like that either. So this is one area, the one area I've seen where he's faced criticism from folks on his right flank as well.
We spoke last week about a possible joint effort of the Charlotte Arts and Science Council to join forces with the Foundation for the Carolinas to once again become or try to become the key arts fundraiser in the city. The ASC had lost that status as their business model began to fail several years ago. And then when the city of Charlotte decided to set up their own funding mechanism and cut the ASC out of the picture. And while that was going on, evidently, Mecklenburg County continued to work with the ASC. Eric, you report that some city officials were surprised about this potential working together of ASC and the foundation. And in fact, Malcolm Graham, City Council's Malcolm Graham, said he felt blindsided by this. What's going on here?
What's going on here is that the city and the county are not playing well together yet again, and they're not listening to one another. And I think I know there are some differences of opinion between the city manager and the county manager. And, all of that is sort of standard, isn't it, Mike? But the problem, or I guess the new problem, new wrinkle in this, is that we're rapidly approaching July 1st, and July 1st is the start of a new fiscal year, and that is when the money runs out from this three-year stopgap problem we've had. So I guess, as with most of us in the journalism business, deadlines are a good thing because they are really scrambling to get this all wrapped up in time for the July start of the new year.
Well, in reading your article about this, you told me something I didn't know. You said that when the city started its own funding mechanism for the arts, it was temporary. That was news to me. This is only temporary? They hired somebody? They put up an organization? I don't know what if anything they've done, but it's temporary?
This infusion fund was a three-year program. The Foundation for the Carolinas raised $6 million from the private sector. The city doubled their spending to $6 million over 3 years. And so that gave $12 million for each of 3 years, ending June 30th of this year. And the 3 years was put in place so that they would have ample time to have an orderly transition and consensus building to ease into the new fiscal year that begins in July. And that hasn't quite panned out, Mike.
Well, they divorced themselves from the ASC to a large degree, the city did. Mm-hmm. And now under this plan, this $21 million, the bulk of it, well, $11 million would come from the city, $10 from the county. Are they likely to say yes to that after they've already made a decision about the ASC?
I think they are likely to say yes to it. I think this is a case of it's going to be messy. No one wants to watch the sausage being made, but I think ultimately it's going to pass and the arts will finally have a stable funding source of roughly $21 million a year. And Dina DiOrio, the county manager, told me that, you know, look, this essentially makes up for the 2019 failed tax referendum. Remember, they were going to go for the quarter cent. That would have given them roughly the same amount. So they're trying to solve the problem that we've talked about 100 times, Mike, which is that the workplace giving has really gone down and they need a stable, steady funding source.
Speaking of tax dollars, we've been watching how tourism tax dollars are being used in various places around the state. Ever since a few weeks ago, a Charlotte City Councilwoman suggested we might consider dipping into our hospitality tax collections for something other than tourist related projects. Buncombe County, where Asheville is, has done that. So did Currituck County. They're being forced in Currituck County to refund $14 million they diverted from tourism after they were successfully sued. And next week, Buncombe County is making some key decisions about the future use of that tax money there, Eli. And you say the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association will be watching. How so?
Yeah, Buncombe is considering using some of this money to subsidize affordable housing. You know, in both Buncombe and Currituck counties, the arguments are kind of like, hey, we need services to go with tourism, and we need places for people who work in the hospitality industry to live. So we're going to use these tax revenues for broader purposes than just, you know, building a convention center or something
but,
like
but
that.
But they've already done it. So why now? Why the attention now?
Yeah. Well, you know, in Charlotte, the city council was talking about doing some of this and looking at, you know, could we use this money for greenways, et cetera. And that kind of kicked up a hornet's nest, I think. The restaurant and lodging association sent a note saying, hey, don't do this. So I think that focused a lot more attention on it.
We have saved the biggest and most important story of the week for last. The anticipation has been building, and when the announcement was made, you could hear all over town the sighs of relief.
We have heard a lot of excitement. We've heard the requests, and we're listening. We're so excited to be able to bring Wegmans to Charlotte.
You heard right. Wegmans is coming. Wegmans is coming. I'm getting a sense of deja vu here. Didn't we go through the same thing, Joe, when Publix arrived?
This is so different, Mike.
And Whole Foods before that.
You will see, and all of you who have never been to Wegmans, you will see when it opens in 2026 the difference.
Well, I don't want to say that this is a cult, but the store does have a cult-like following.
Many people have gotten together in their little local areas or their local original areas where they came from, and they road trip out there. They bring stuff back for each other. People go out there on the weekend, spend $800, $1,200 on Wegman food.
That's Thomas Bailey. He's the founder of a Wegman's Facebook group. Now, we're talking about people driving, what, from here to the nearest Wegman's?
Every week. They road trip together. They go in this Facebook group and they ask people to bring back stuff for them. They ask if people want to go up there with them. I met one couple in the Chapel Hill store who commutes from like Fort Mill, just the grocery shop there. They buy a cooler. They buy bags of ice. They load it up and bring everything home. And I've actually flown home with Wegmans items too. So
you're part of the cult. You probably have an iPhone too. So this is going to be in Ballantyne, and Dan Aiken is the vice president of of real estate and store planning who explained to you why they chose Ballantyne for their first location here.
And we had a few other sites under consideration, but at the end of the day, we just felt that that was our best location to give us regional access and really be able to reach as many people as we possibly could with our first entry into the market.
Now, if you don't live near Ballantyne, please don't despair. This just might be the start of something big.
We think we can do multiple stores in the market, given the size of the market. We don't have anything else to announce and don't have any other deals finalized, but we're definitely looking.
Someplace else to clear the store shelves of milk and bread when it snows. But then again, it never snows anymore. Eli Portillo, Alexandria Sands, Joe Bruno, Eric Spanberg, thank you for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.